Our new book, Bigfoot Attacked My Tiny House at the South Coast Comic-Con.
And tickets are still available. It won't come out on Amazon until after the convention.
Bigfoot Attacked My Tiny House.
Scary Stories by Peter Bernard, Volume 1. Forward by TV's famous Timothy Green Beckley, better known as Mr. UFO.
At the South Coast Comic-Con. And tickets are still available.
Welcome to Scary Stories, the channel that tells you scary stories.
Welcome to Scary Stories. I'm PQ River. Our writer, Peter Bernard, is appearing this weekend, July 22nd and 23rd at the comic convention being thrown in Hanover, Massachusetts by Gary Somers from Antiques Roadshow. Just in time for that, we've been handed these two never-before-told stories from an 82-year-old lifelong resident of Massachusetts who insists there are strange, undocumented, monstrous creatures living less than 100 miles outside of the city of Boston. Here's Madeline Starr to begin the countdown.
Scary Stories by Peter Bernard. Number 1.
The Freetown Flyer is told to Peter Bernard, read by PQ River. Dear Scary Stories, I'm not going to tell you who I am, except to say that I was born and lived my entire life in the area between Freetown and Fall River, Massachusetts. For those of you not from around here, that's an area which still, to this day, includes protected land, which has been wild forest and swamp since before the time of the dinosaurs. There are a number of legends originating from both Native American and settler cultures about this spot that go back as far as you can imagine and further than you might have thought possible. Today I'm going to tell you about two things that happened to me, personally, when I was a teenager. My uncle, who claimed to be a shaman, told me when I was very young that my family are descended from both English settlers, dating back to the Mayflower on one side, and the Wampanoag native people on the other. He took me around the forests and towns and showed me many things, such as the Dighton Rock, which he gave me the translation of, or at least the translation handed down to him by the man who trained him. According to what he told me, the rock was not carved by the Wampanoag people, but by people who lived here before them. He told me a story about a shaman, many generations ago, who had a dream, in which it was explained to him that the rock depicts both the origin story of that more ancient people and a mathematical formula for the creation of life given by K'Tanit to that ancient race. K'Tanit was and is the great spirit who is dreaming this reality we inhabit. With his blessing, the two tribes then interbred, and their offspring became the Wampanoag. Supposedly, the more primitive and evil tribe they had been battling was driven deep into the Hockomock Swamp, where they may still live to this day. Now, this part of Massachusetts does have a reputation for monsters, but it also is both so remote and so close to major population centers that it also has a reputation for attracting the human kinds of monsters as well, such as gangsters wanting a nice, quiet place to commit murder, and Satanists wanting a nice, quiet place to, well, let's not talk about it. A lot of people think that devil worship, blood sacrifice stuff started in the 1960s, but my grandfather told me stories going back to when he was a kid that would just about curl your toenails. Let's just say I'd rather get the swamp monsters mad at me than those people. For this reason, I say, let's only talk about the non-human kinds of monsters today. This first story happened when I was around 15-ish, so let's say 1950 or so. I had two friends that I would skip school with and go to the swamps with and make a day of it. The tricky part was getting to the swamps without being seen by the truant officer or anyone who might alert the truant officer. We only had one in our area, and he'd been on the job since before we were born, so he knew how kids my age thought. He didn't just patrol the main streets, he patrolled every small block and every bunch of houses it was easy to cut through the backyards of. Once we would finally make it to the swamp, we knew we were home free because no civilized adult would go into the swamps if he didn't absolutely have to. That didn't mean we didn't run into people there, but they just weren't civilized. They were savage and free, same as we fancied ourselves to be at the time. But like I said, this isn't a story about humans. So let's jump straight to the meat of the sandwich then. Me and my two buddies, both of whom are now deceased, saw a flying reptile. We saw some kind of pterosaur or a descendant of such a type of leathery winged animal. Here's exactly what happened to the best of my memory, which may be a bit stretched since I've told the story so many times in front of campfires on dark nights. One warm day, it was late May, I believe, my friends and I were having so much fun making each other laugh and so forth that we headed further into the forest than we ever had before, and we suddenly realized that the sun was going down. We had always started back before the sun started to set. Even the latest times we ever left the forest, it was always still light out. This time, even if we beat it out of there quickly as we could, it was going to be dark long before we got out of there. When I told this story to my grandson, he said, "Wow, Grandpa, you guys were screwed." Yes, we were. We knew it, too. Panicking, my heart racing faster and faster, I urged the guys to rush as we headed back to safety, but it seemed that they were lagging behind me. I heard them calling to me, but I didn't hear what they were saying. I told them to hurry, and then suddenly I heard two blood-curdling screams, and I was so surprised I ran back into a tree and then fell back on my ass. I sat there, wondering if I had imagined the screams, when suddenly there came two more. Both my friends were screaming in pain or fear. I was on my feet before I knew it, running away from the screams until guilt overtook me and I ran back to where my friends had been screaming. When I reached them, I didn't see anything I could have possibly expected to see. My friends were wrestling with an animal, somewhat larger than either of them, colored dark gray, with leathery skin and a long alligator mouth with terrifying-looking teeth in it. One of my friends had it by the throat and was using his entire body to hold its neck away from biting either of them, and the other had his arms wrapped around the torso of the creature. The three of them were rolling back and forth on the grass, covered in dirt and mud and blood. I wonder, what do I do? And I guess I said it out loud because both of the guys at the same time started screaming at me to bash its head in with a rock. I started looking around at once for the large rock they requested, but you know what life can be like. You curse all the acorns clogging up your house's gutter, but then you can't find any acorns at all when you start craving acorn spatzel. So, of course, I couldn't find any large rocks that weren't too big for me to pick up. I started pelting the animal with small rocks, not knowing what else to do. One of them hit my friend holding the torso. He shouted in pain and released his grip, allowing the creature to wriggle away from both of them. Up till now, I really had no idea what they were wrestling with there on the ground. Since it had no fur, I had assumed it was something diseased, maybe something with mange. As it got away from them, it reared up on two legs, and to my shock, unfurled wings to either side of it. These were not bird wings, although their shape was similar. They were more like bat wings, except they were one flap of leather each, not separated into segments like a bat's wings are. It also had a tail I hadn't taken conscious notice of before, and so the overall effect was that I was looking at some sort of man-sized dragon. It had an alligator mouth and a serpent's head on a bird's body ending in a lizard's tail, and as it started flapping its wings, I realized that it flew. Its first flap created so much wind that I got knocked off balance and dust went in my eyes and down my throat. We three were left choking and gagging on the ground for a while until the dust settled and we realized the bird monster was gone. As soon as they felt a little better, both guys were punching me and yelling at me that I was an idiot and I had lost them the eighth wonder of the world that was going to make us all $1 million. I laughed and asked them which pawn shop was paying $1 million for a flying alligator, and they started yelling at me that it was a dinosaur. A dinosaur? Well, they meant pterosaur, which we all later found out was not technically a dinosaur, but did live back then. Once they said that to me, I wished I could kick and punch myself for letting it get away. That summer we decided we would stalk the big bird and catch it and make a name for ourselves. A good plan, right? Except someone let the plan leak. And once our parents found out we'd been hanging in the swamps hunting wild animals that could have killed us, we were all grounded and not allowed to see each other until school started up again in the fall. It's not to say we didn't sometimes break our parents' rules and sneak out together. In fact, I'm about to tell you a story about one time we did, but we never saw the flying dinosaur monster thing again. I have so many regrets related to that story, they haunt me more than any ghost story ever could. I have one more monster story from that summer to tell, so don't go away.
Number 2.
The Westport Wild Man, as told to Peter Bernard, read by P.Q. River. Back in the summer of 1950 or 51, when I was 15 or 16 years old, I broke my parents' rules and snuck out one night when they thought I was asleep to party with friends I was banned from seeing. I didn't just see my friends that night, though. I also saw a man-animal hybrid from the dawn of time, a fellow that my friends and I called the Westport Wild Man. For the sake of this story, let's call one of my friends Joe. He lived in Freetown near me at the time. And let's call the other Mo. Now, Mo's family were spending the summer with richer relatives who lived down in a part of Westport overlooking water. I never actually saw the place, but it sounded nice from the descriptions I'd heard. Anyway, part of the deal with Mo staying at his relative's place was that he was no longer grounded. He could roam where he wanted to as long as he stayed away from me and Joe, who were seen by his parents as bad influences. Mo had been wandering into this natural area just south of the bio-reserve over there, and on more than one occasion, he claimed he had seen a hairy ape man. Now, this was years before I had heard of Bigfoot, but there were lots of ape men in movies. Maybe they were supposed to be gorillas, but they were guys in suits. So that's what I envisioned when I heard Mo describe what he had seen. Since Mo said he only ever saw the monster man right around sunset, we figured if we were going to hunt for him, it should be at night. We set a date 2 weeks into the future so that we could give ourselves the time to work out the logistics of how we would break our grounding without being discovered. For those 2 weeks, I went to bed earlier each night and got up earlier each day. Both my parents were early risers, so not only did they notice this new behavior, but they congratulated me for it and were nicer to me for a while. Then, on the night in question, I went to bed at 9, locked my door, and exited through the bedroom window to go hunt the monkey man. Now, although the Westport Wild Man was our nickname for the creature, the area in which it was seen was actually north of Westport, I'm pretty sure. I'm looking at a Google map as I'm writing this, and I'm not 100% certain which of the green areas I'm looking at is the correct one, or if it even exists any longer. My memory tells me it was an area south of the bioreserve, but Google seems to be labeling all these green areas as the bioreserve, so I'm not really certain. At any rate, we met at a pre-designated place and time, then Mo led us to the spot where he'd seen the ape man twice. It was dark there. It was very dark there. We weren't even in the trees yet, just in this tall grass that I didn't realize was loaded with ticks I'd be pulling off my body half the next day. Mo said, "Give your eyes a minute to adjust to the light." But they never really did. You know why? Because it was really dark there. After a minute or two, Joe started moaning that we needed to go back and get a flashlight or just forget about this. His voice sounded really scared. I hadn't been frightened up to that point, but hearing Joe sound quavery-voiced made me feel scared, too. Mo sighed heavily at both of us and produced a flashlight from his pocket. He held it low and pointed it at the ground between us. "I have a flashlight with me, as you two quivering little lambs can see," Mo mocked us. "But are you sure you want to use it?" We quickly said yes and began grabbing for the light from his hands. He pulled it back from us, careful to keep its light confined to a small area directly beneath us. "Before you make up your mind to use this flashlight," he admonished us, "you should know the drawbacks of using it." That got our attention, and we listened to him quietly. "One," he began, "it will not only light up the forest for ourselves, but for anyone or anything else that might be here with us. And two, it will alert that aforementioned anything else to where we are."
"So?"
asked Joe. "So," answered Mo. "Then it can kill and eat us more easily." The silence was deafening as we considered what Mo said. Then Joe snatched the flashlight away, saying something like, "It still beats this. At least we'll see what's eating me." Once the light was his, Joe swung it wildly around, and for the first time I got a clear look at the tree line about 90 or 100 feet past us. It was around the distance from home plate to first base, at least in my memory. There was a solid wall of trees extending past the light of the flashlight to the left and right. After swaying back and forth for a few seconds, Joe centered the flashlight on the hairy figure standing there. There was a man-shaped figure standing there, perfectly still. I remember gasping so hard that I choked myself, and Joe let the flashlight drop from his grip. I caught it before it hit the ground and immediately aimed it back at the figure, who had not moved. It was still standing perfectly still, so I just aimed the light, squinted my eyes, and tried to take in as much detail as possible. The tall grass was blocking off everything below his knees, but he at first appeared to be covered in fur except on his face and on his hands, which he held perfectly still, hanging from his sides. His proportions were roughly human. His arms may have been a little longer than mine, but they were not ape arms. And why was there no fur on the back of his hands? As I continued to study his appearance, I noticed he had long black hair coming from the top of his head and going down on either side like Veronica Lake or someone, but dirty and matted with lots of split ends. He also appeared to have a beard, so he was not an ape, no matter how far his brow seemed to protrude from his forehead. His skin was very tanned, but something like Caucasian or possibly Native American skin. His features resembled neither. In short, he was something impossible that could not have been there. And he still hadn't moved. I felt a wave of relief as I became convinced this was just a gag. It was a dummy. Mo had erected a dummy, and he had made dummies of me and Joe. I started laughing and told Mo I got the joke. Mo just looked confused. He told me it wasn't a joke. I said, if it's not a joke, then why hadn't the ape man moved? I grabbed the flashlight and pointed it back to the same spot on the tree line to illustrate my point. The ape man was no longer there. The three of us reacted in unison, all shouting and cursing and grabbing for the flashlight. I pulled it away and scanned back and forth until I found the ape man. He was walking towards us. He was now halfway to us. I could see now that he was not an ape. He was wearing a fur skin wrapped tightly around his upper torso. His hair hung low down his back. He was not an ape. He was a primitive proto-human wearing possibly bear skin. As we watched, he bared his teeth and emitted a guttural growling sound. Then he started to run at us while growling. I would love to regale you with the specifics of how three imbecilic 15 or 16-year-old kids from Massachusetts evaded a furious caveman as he chased them in pitch darkness through tall grass and back to civilization, but I literally do not remember any part of the rest of the story. I have deduced that we got away, since I am not dead yet as I type this. How exactly we did it, though, is anyone's guess. I never asked Joe or Mo about their side of the story, and they're both gone now for years. So this is the interactive part of the story, as you get to choose your own conclusion. Did we turn around and beat him up? Did he stop running and let us get away? Was he only trying to scare us off of his turf? Did he capture us and beam us up to his spacecraft, perform intrusive and unnecessary surgery on us, then erase our memories, leaving us with missing time? Your guess is as good as mine. For all I know, it really was a joke that Mo cooked up with a friend of his. The caveman was larger than us, but he didn't seem to be larger than man-sized. It could have been one of Mo's bigger friends from town or something. Maybe he was just wearing half a gorilla suit and a Don Post caveman mask. I don't know, and I suspect I never will know. But in my gut, I'll tell you, I think what we saw that night was what my generation used to call the missing link, or the creature that came between apes and man on the evolutionary ladder. I think we survived a genuine attack by a prehistoric caveman less than 100 miles away from Boston, Massachusetts. That's my story, and no matter what you say, I say it's true. The end.
Check us out on our YouTube channel, Scary Stories NYC. Bigfoot Attacked My Tiny House. Scary Stories by Peter Bernard, Volume 1. now available on Amazon in paperback, Kindle, and audiobook versions. Narrated by P.Q. Ribber and me, Madeline Starr. Forward by TV's famous Timothy Green Beckley, better known as Mr. UFO.
And if there's anyone out there who can't get enough of P.Q. Ribber, search in your favorite search engine for P.Q. Ribber, and you'll find plenty of podcasts, music, and weirdness.
Come back for more scary stories.